you, Mr. Hoover. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning. Good morning.
Happy Holy Day. Happy Feast. So, when Mr. DeCampos asked me to give the sermon here, he said it would be a really good idea to speak about the day. I thought that was a marvelous idea. So, that's what we'll be doing. We'll be speaking about the day, and the title is Beware the Leaven and Celebrate Freedom. Beware the Leaven and Celebrate Freedom. Now, you might think, those don't really go together. Maybe. It's like, being beware of leaven, what does that have to do with freedom? Well, what I'd like to do is to discuss that. That's the theme for the message. But to break it into two chapters. So chapter one, Old Testament, Old Covenant. Beware the leaven. Celebrate the freedom. What did it mean? What happened on this day back then? And then chapter two, it's probably not a surprise. You might be able to fill in a blank. The exact same theme, but let's look at it from the New Testament, the New Covenant perspective. Beware the leaven, celebrate the freedom. So let's go start Exodus chapter 12, the very first place in the Bible where leavening is mentioned. So it starts in Exodus chapter 12 and verse 15. It says, you shall keep it as a feast by an everlasting ordinance. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. The very first mention of unleavening right there. On the first day you shall remove leaven from your houses, for whoever eats leavened bread from the first day until the seventh day, that person shall be cut off from Israel. Now, one of the first thoughts that came to me as I was researching and digging into this, I had the mistaken assumption that leavening in the Old Testament was clearly related to sin. And that you could see scriptures, and that there should be a direct tie-in or correlation, right? Not really. It was a physical removing of leavening, but it doesn't really tie into sin directly until we kind of tie in the whole story and what was happening leaving Egypt, and it was a baptism through the Red Sea and then leaving sin behind. So chapter 2 of the message, we'll talk a lot more about leavening equal sin. But at this point, the meaning of removing the leavening, let's continue on a little bit more. So first of all, whoever eats leavened bread from the first day until the seventh, that person shall be cut off from Israel. And let's also think about, as they remove leaven from their houses, they didn't have houses like we have houses. These were the slaves living in Israel. They might have had tents. So how hard was it to de-leaven the tent? Should have been fairly simple. They might have had some houses, so the Ten Commandments movie pictures some of the houses that might have been there. Who knows how accurate that was? The houses might have had dirt floors. How difficult was it to really de-leaven at that point? But as we go on, so whoever eats leaven from the first day until the seventh, the person shall be cut off from Israel. On the first day, there should be a holy congregation or holy convocation. On the seventh, there should be a holy convocation. We are here on the seventh day as a holy convocation, celebrating this part of the unleavened bread. No manner of work shall be done. Everyone must eat. Only be prepared. So you shall observe the Feast of Unleavened Bread for the same day. And I will have brought your armies out of the land of Egypt. Now, when I was reading this, it surprised me. Who had the armies in Egypt? Pharaoh. Who was the armies chasing Israel? Pharaoh. 600 chariots. The army was coming. Did Israel have an army leaving Egypt? Not really. We'll talk about it's coming up, 600,000 men, maybe a couple of million people, but that wasn't really an army. But this word army is just like a bunch of people. So it actually is translated army correctly, but I think it's not meaning that there is a literal Israelite army leaving Egypt. Therefore, observe this day throughout your generations as an everlasting ordinance. And then at evening you shall eat the unleavened bread until the 21st day of the month. 7 days no leaven shall be found in your houses, since whoever eats what is leavened, that same person shall be cut off. Whether he's a stranger or a native, you shall eat nothing leavened in all your dwellings. You shall eat unleavened bread. So a question for you guys, as you've gone through this last week, any leavening slip-ups, any surprises come across the plate? For me, no. I had a business meal at lunch. It was like, this lady asked, so what are you going to order? And I said this. She goes, oh, are you trying to be like gluten-free or stay away from carbs? So like today, those are pretty easy descriptions. But I do remember, and I think it's my only slip-up like this. Sophomore at Big Sandy, just had been baptized, went to Spring Holy Days with some friends to Texarkana, and we're going through a cafeteria like a Luby's, or I don't know what it was back then. And going through with my friends, I remember we were making jokes about everything to start with. here's a salad. Oh, I hope that lettuce is unleavened. Then it was like green beans. And excuse me, ma'am, do you know if the green beans have any leaven? And we were just joking all the way through. And I was like, oh, I was so sure. We were so careful and cautious. The very last thing going through the line, the gentleman asked, would you like a roll? I said, sure. And I didn't even think about it. And I go and sit down. And my friends from college, and they're looking at me like, you know, what are you doing? And then finally somebody told me right before I took the first bite. And it's like, wow, somebody should have told me that a long time ago. But it also says we're supposed to avoid leavening. We're supposed to eat unleavened bread throughout the week. But we can be on guard. We can try and be careful for every kind of thing. No lettuce that's leavened. No green beans that are leavened. But every once in a while, this roll that should have, like, of course that's leavened, just sometimes pops in. So anyway, let's go back to the scripture. So it talks about, so we concluded, that's the portion in chapter 12 that talks about the leavening. Then it goes into the 10th plague, so the death of the firstborn is happening, or happened. And then verse 31, so it says, then he, this is the Pharaoh, called for Moses and Aaron by night. So now this was, Passover lamb was slain, death angel came, firstborn killed that very same night, late in the night, or maybe really early in the morning. So I think this by night, was it 11:30 p.m.? Was it 2 a.m.? Who knows? We don't know the time, but it was by night and said, rise, go out from among my people, both you and the children of Israel, and go. Serve the Lord as you have said. Also take your flocks and your herds as you have said, and be gone and bless me also. So I'd heard a message a little while back from a friend. His name is Scott McKeon down in Arizona. And he talked about that they would relive this as their family, and his oldest son would be Moses, and he would be Pharaoh. And so the youngest son, or the oldest son, would come up and say, let my people go. And Scott would say, no. And then the son would say, let my people go. Scott would say, no. And then the last time, let my people go. And then Scott would say, yes. And all the little kids ran around the room, and they threw a blue blanket up to be the water coming down. But there's different ways to try to reenact the Bible with your children or with your friends or things to consider. But so now the Egyptians, in verse 30, the Egyptians urged the people that they might send them out of the land in haste, for they said, we shall all be dead. So the people took their dough before it was leavened, having their kneading bowls bound up in the cloth, clothes on their shoulders. One of the key meanings of the Old Testament, the physical approach to removing leavening, was to give the Israelites a reminder, you had to go in haste. The couple of mentions where it's tying leavening and the meaning in the Old Testament, it's to remember that, hey, this wasn't a planned trip. This wasn't a year from now. Let's just take, you know, pack everything up and let's have a really leisurely trip. This was going in haste. So the people took their dough before it was leavened. Now the children of Israel had done according to the word of Moses. They'd asked for the Egyptians silver, gold, clothing. The Lord had given the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians so that they granted them what they requested. And then they plundered the Egyptians. Then the children of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Succoth, about 600,000 men. So I'll talk about the people, and then I want to go back to the word plundering a little bit. 600,000 men. So how big was this population that was then leaving Egypt? In today's calculations, you can say, okay, if there were 600,000 men, you take a multiplier of 2.4, and you just assume how many people are married, how many people have children, so that would be about a 1.4 million. But there's a verse that shows us that it's likelier a bigger number than this, and that would be Exodus 1, chapter 7. So since we're so close, we can go back to Exodus chapter 1 and verse 7. It says, but the children of Israel were fruitful, increased abundantly, multiplied, grew exceedingly mighty, and the land was filled with them. So the question is, do you think that they had the same number of children back then that people have today? I would suggest that they had more kids back then. The family unit size was bigger. So if 600,000 men, we would guess, would be 1.5 million, it's probably somewhere between 2 and 4 million people total. And several of the concordances and commentaries I was looking at, they're guessing that, but nobody has an idea. But let's just say this. It was big. There were a lot of people. Think about a crowd. Have you, you know, what's one of the largest crowds that you've been a part of? When I think of a crowd and getting ready to leave, one of the things that I've done for the last, 15 years is run the turkey trot up in Cincinnati. So it's 6.2 miles. Thanksgiving morning, and I've had my son run a few times with me, and friends, and That's just the way that I start Thanksgiving. And the way that they do it there is, in most races, they have between 10 and 20,000 people have attended those races. So let's just say 15,000 people. And then there's banners that say, if you think you're going to run a 6-minute mile, then you can start here, closer to the starting line. If you're going to do a 7-minute mile, further back, 8, 9. So I used to be at 9, and now I'm 10, and now I'm behind 10. So if like, how fast are you going to run? That's where you're going to be at. When they say go, you can hear it through the loudspeaker, but you can't see it. Even at the 9-minute mile pace, it's around a corner. When they say it's time to go, I don't know that except through the loudspeaker, but nobody moves. How long do you think it takes that crowd to unwind before I cross the starting line to begin the race? It's more than 5 minutes. Now that's 15,000 people. That's narrow streets of Cincinnati. That takes a while. What would it have been like to unwind 600,000 people, 2 million people, and now let's go back to plunder? So it's not like these were 2 million people all in a line, 100 across or 200 across, and they're going straight. 2 million people, kids, families, elderly, animals, and plunder. So I could imagine, okay, everybody says we've got to go. And then the wife would say, okay, plunder some good things, but don't get anything too heavy. And make sure it's like whatever those instructions would be. It's like, how would that go? But plundering took place, and that livestock took place. And then it goes back to this mixed multitude, a great deal of livestock. They baked unleavened cakes of dough, which they brought out of Egypt, for it was not leavened, for they were driven out of Egypt, and they could not wait. So here's another sign of this, the purpose or the importance of haste tied to unleavened. And they had not prepared provisions for themselves. So now let's jump to chapter 13 as we continue this theme. Feast of Unleavened Bread, verse 3 of chapter 13. Moses said to the people, remember this day in which you went out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage, for the strength of the hand of the Lord have brought you out of this place. No leavened bread shall be eaten. And now, let's continue. On this day you are going out in the month of Abib, and it shall be when the Lord brings you into the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, which he swore to your fathers to give to you, a land flowing with milk and honey. And we heard a little bit about milk and honey earlier. This is a foreshadowing of what's another event that took place on the last day of unleavened bread. So there's two specific events that we believe from the Old Testament took place on this very day. One was the actual crossing through the Red Sea, and we're about to get to that. The other was the walls coming down at Jericho. Now that's not 100% certain that the Jericho, but that's very, very likely, and there's many commentaries, that would agree with that. So if you think about this verse 5, would this be a foreshadowing that, hey, on the same very day and what's coming up through these days of unleavened bread, this is going into the land with milk and honey. Continues with the 7 days shall you eat, and then it goes down to verse 9. It shall be as a sign on your hand and as a memorial between your eyes that the Lord's law may be in your mouth. This, when we go into chapter 2 about beware the leaven, a little what spoiler alert? What do you think beware the leaven? What are one of the topics in the New Testament? Beware the leaven of the Pharisees. What were the Pharisees known to do? Were the broad phylacteries to have all and oversized. So the idea here it's talking about, it should be a sign, a memorial, the Lord's law may be in your mouth. There could be a connection or something to consider with that. And you shall therefore keep this ordinance in its season from year to year. Now let's jump over to verse 24. So it shall be when your son asks you in time to come, what is this? That you shall say to him, by strength of hand the Lord brought us out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. And it came to pass when Pharaoh was stubborn about letting us go, he said no a few times, right? And then it was yes, and then the people took off in haste, letting us go, that the Lord killed all the firstborn in the land, both the firstborn of man and of beast. Therefore sacrifice the Lord all males that opened the womb, but all the firstborn of my sons I redeem. It shall be as a sign on your hands and as frontless between your eyes, for by strength of hand the Lord brought us out of Egypt. Let's continue on now. So it goes into the wilderness way, and then the Red Sea crossing. So one of the key parts of today being the last day of unleavened bread, we believe that the crossing of the Red Sea actually took place today. So it was 7 days where the Israelites were moving this massive amount of people. How far could they have traveled? If a normal walking pace is like 3 miles an hour, let's say that they average even 2 miles an hour, which might have been tough if they had animals and children and elderly and carts and plunder and everything else. If they did 2 miles an hour, how many hours a day do you think they were good to walk? 8, 9? So maybe 20 miles at most? I'm guessing it's less than that. So they had 7 days of wandering. They then ended up in a dead end. They had mountains on both sides, and then we know what happened. But let's read this through and add some color and commentary. So speak to the children of Israel that they turn and camp before Pi-Hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea opposite Baal-Zephon. Now that's exactly getting boxed in with the Pharaoh's army coming. So Pharaoh will say of the children of Israel, they are bewildered by the land. The wilderness has closed them in. Then I will harden Pharaoh's heart so he will pursue them. I will gain honor over Pharaoh and over all his army, that the Egyptians may know that I am the Lord. And they did so. Continue on with verse 7. How many chariots? There were 600 chariots plus the army. How big was the army? We don't know. But the Egyptians pursued them, the horses, the chariots of Pharaoh, and they overtook them camping by the sea. When Pharaoh drew near, the children lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. So they were very afraid. So imagine this family unit. Mom says plunder the good stuff, but not too heavy. They've got little children, maybe. They've got blisters now. They're not used to maybe walking that far, that much. Sand, going into sandals. Did they have sandals? I don't know. But at that point, then, they're very afraid. They've gone through all of this. They said to Moses, there's no graves in Egypt. Have you taken us away to die? So they're starting to get concerned. And this is when Moses gives the famous quotes of, do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, for which he'll accomplish for you today. But the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall see no more again forever. The Lord will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace. So it continues on. But now I'd like to go to verse 21. So it says, Moses stretched out his hand over the sea. The Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night and made the sea into dry land. And I was thinking about this with, how long do you think it took the Israelites to cross the Red Sea? We don't know. So here, it was all night. How big was the Red Sea? How wide was it? How far were the waters parted? We don't know. But Moses started off all that night. He made the sea into the dry land. The children of Israel went into the midst of the sea on the dry ground. The waters were a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. Imagine a little family with a little boy might be looking at and say, look at that fish. I wonder if we can go fishing here. They probably didn't see fish like that coming off the edges of the water. Who knows what that view would have been like. The Egyptians pursued, went after them in the midst of the sea. And now, verse 24, how long did it take? Now it came to pass in the morning watch. So when was the morning watch? Tradition says it was between 2 and 6 a.m. Likely this was just before 6 a.m. in the morning. So what we know so far is Moses stretched out his hand. All that night, the waters were parted. And then in the morning watch, so maybe it was just starting to have some sunlight because the people had to have seen the chariots coming through to then have God's miracle then put the Red Sea back together. But it came back on the morning watch, so about 6 a.m., let's say, that the Lord looked down upon the army of the Egyptians through the pillar of the fire in the cloud, and he troubled the army of the Egyptians. He took off their chariot wheels, so they drove them with difficulty. I bet they would be driving with difficulty at that point. The Egyptians said, let's flee from the face of Israel. The Lord fights for them, and by that point it was too late. And then the waters covered them up. So the point of trying to go through this in a fairly quick manner, but was trying to share and add this as a story to think about, what's the meaning of today in the Old Testament, beware the leaven, celebrate the freedom. So far we've talked a little bit about beware the leaven. They were told, go in haste, you shall eat unleavened bread for 7 days. What about the freedom? The freedom would be, what would it have been like to be a part of that 2 million person group, to have been scared just the day before, thinking you are now in a box canyon, you are now trapped, there is nowhere to go. And now the next day, 6 a.m. in the morning, you turn back and look. There's no army chasing you. Pharaoh's army has disappeared. There are no longer chariots there. What would that sense of freedom be like for that people at that time? That would be amazing. So if we think about, from that perspective, celebrate the freedom that those people would have felt being, in effect, baptizing through the Red Sea, but then turning around and seeing now there's peace. Now there's no longer an army chasing them. Now we know shortly after that there became complaining and they were hungry and there were other issues. But for that moment, I think celebrate the freedom certainly is a direct correlation or tie-in with this. So I'd like to bring this to kind of a modern twist to this and just say, let's think about this through a family today. And I've hinted at this throughout, but let's say it was in modern day today. At 3 a.m., somebody came knocking on your door and said, it's time to go. We have to flee. The Pharaoh just said we can go. What would you be doing? You'd say, well, we have to figure out what are we going to take, and this isn't something that we had planned for, and how much do we carry, and how do we handle the family, and what do we do with the grandparents, and how are we handling with the cousins, and now all of a sudden, how is everybody going to be organized and with livestock to go? That just would have been an amazing time. So I think also is that we would have been walking. I think that there would have been quite a few times where I would have heard the question, are we there yet? Are we there yet? Could you imagine 7 days with the children? And they would be saying, boy, I think we should be about there. Oh no, now we've got trouble. So who knows exactly what it was like back then, but I think the more that we can picture and try to bring that to life, the more hopefully then the scripture brings meaning to us. So now let's go to the other part of the Old Testament. I mentioned this earlier, but Jericho. I just want to go to Joshua chapter 6, and we'll just briefly talk about this, and then we'll move on to chapter 2. So Joshua chapter 6 and verse 15. But it came to pass on the seventh day, so just recognize that Jericho is a huge walled city. That was exactly where the Israelites were wanting to go through, and that was going to be the land of milk and honey. But there was a problem. This city was massive. It was fortified. And they were not going to be able to get into the promised land unless something happened. So now there's 7 days, and there was the specific rulings on what to do and how to do it. But here on the seventh day, which would picture, we believe, today back in that time, it came to pass on the seventh day they rose early about the dawning of the day, marched around the city 7 times in the same manner. On that day only they marched around the city 7 times. The seventh time it happened, when the priests blew the trumpets, Joshua said to the people, shout, for the Lord has given you the city. If we continue down to verse 20, so the people shouted when the priests blew the trumpets. It happened when the people heard the sound of the trumpet. People shouted with a great shout that the wall fell down flat. So that the fact that the wall fell down flat shouldn't surprise any of us. I think we know how that story goes. But here's what I'd like to just further amplify the idea of celebrating freedom. So on this last day of unleavened bread, way back then, before Jericho's walls fell, the Israelites wouldn't have had an idea, how are we going to be free to go into the promised land? Here's a walled city that's bigger than anything we can deal with. They didn't have siege engines. They didn't have a way to go attack. And all of a sudden, God did their fighting for them, circled the wall 7 times, shouted, and the walls fell down. So to further amplify the thought of chapter 1, beware the leaven, celebrate freedom. Celebrating freedom really would have been had an exciting moment on this day back then, because now the walls were down. Now the people were free to move into the promised land. So that's the conclusion of chapter 1. Oh, I had a note I was just going to mention. Our daughter went to Center College years ago. She went on a study abroad trip for a month to Egypt. So last night we were talking on the phone. She says hi. And said, I asked her, so what do you remember about Egypt? And you know, leaving Egypt, you actually are one of the few people I know that she's gone to Egypt and she left Egypt. So what does she have to say? And she said a couple of things. She said her advice was, make sure that you don't accept a sprig of basil from anybody, because that means that you're engaged. So somebody gave her basil. She had a friend with her. And it's like, oh, no, no. So then she walked away. But that's one of the things that they do there. She said that Isis has another meaning. So Isis was an Egyptian god there in Egypt. And there's a lot of things that are called Isis. There are bottles of water called Isis. And it has nothing to do with Isis as we understand or know the term here. There was a band that was called Isis. Anyway, very hot and windy. but also friendly, wonderful people, and they really protect tourists, and she would encourage anybody to go. So she's been there, she then left Egypt, and there you go. So now let's move on to chapter 2. So, New Testament, New Covenant, beware the leaven, and celebrate the freedom. So we've already talked about one part of the leaven, so let's just start here with the leaven, where it begins, and then I'd like to add some things that you may or may not have thought of on this one. So Luke chapter 12 and verse 1 might be a verse that comes to mind. Beware the leaven, as it's mentioned in the New Testament. Luke chapter 12 and verse 1. In the meantime, innumerable multitude of people had gathered together so that they trampled one another. He began to say to his disciples, first of all, beware of the leaven. Of what or of who? Of the Pharisees. And what is it? Here it's hypocrisy. For there is nothing covered that will not be revealed, nor hidden that will not be known. So, an easy starting point for what is the leaven that we are to beware of as it would relate to this day and this in our Christian lives. Beware the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. They're also known for teaching for doctrines and commandments of men. And let's talk through that a little bit. So, what comes to mind when you think of the Pharisee? So I mentioned earlier in the Old Testament, it talks about the frontlet and the eyes and the phylacteries, and that was one of the things that they would do to draw attention. But the Pharisees, until I studied into this recently, I didn't know that there were never more than 6,000 Pharisees in Israel. And also, a person chose to be a Pharisee. And it was tied to, they wanted to follow not only the Bible, but the entire Talmud, the entire Torah, all of the oral traditions tied together. So I like to kind of imagine a word picture associated with something. So here's the Pharisee. Two words for you. Choice. They chose to become a Pharisee. And traditions. And I think of the Fiddler on the Roof and the song Tradition. And that's so important, is the tradition. And that was so important to the Pharisees. So what happened was a Pharisee would take a pledge in front of three witnesses that they would spend all of their lives observing every detail of the scribal law, the oral traditions. The name means separated ones. So a person chose to take an oath to become a Pharisee. About 5,000 or 6,000 Pharisees were all that there were. They were, that name was then the separated ones. So the laws of Moses includes the ceremonial washings before the meals. They also were hungry twice a week. You know why? So Pharisees fasted twice a week because they believed that on Thursday is when Moses went up Mount Sinai, and on Monday is when he went back down. So if you wanted an easy date, you could ask to treat a Pharisee to lunch on a Thursday or on a Monday because they're going to be fasting. So let's look at two things to highlight the Pharisees, and then we'll continue to expand this. So Matthew chapter 7 and verse 1. Matthew chapter 7 and verse 1. Oh, I'm sorry, Mark. You know what? Maybe at some point I'm about to have to break down with glasses. Fonts are shrinking. I have a large print Bible. I printed a large font, but apparently the K and the T are not distinct enough for me. So Mark chapter 7 and verse 1. Sorry about that. So then the Pharisees, so the separated ones. And who are some of the separated ones we can think of in the Bible? Well, there was Gamaliel. And who learned at the feet of Gamaliel? Well, there was Paul. There was Nicodemus. You know a few. So the Pharisees and some of the scribes came together to him, having come from Jerusalem. When they came, they saw some of the disciples eating bread with defiled and unwashed hands. I did find an article. There's like 10 different ways that people, the Pharisees, had to wash their hands to be ceremonially clean. And if somebody didn't do it right, that they're really in trouble. That's what it's talking about here. So they didn't roll their sleeves above their elbows. They didn't wash with enough soap, or they didn't do enough something. But they were ceremonially unclean, and the Pharisees got really upset with this. And that's where then verse 7 says, "And in vain they worship me, teaching us doctrines, the commandments of men." Because the Pharisees taught the traditions were just as important as the law. And somebody that's certainly not washing their hands right, well, that person has to be a horrible person. And that's then what's tied into that. Let's go to Luke chapter 18 and verse 11. Luke chapter 18 and verse 11. parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector. Spoke this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and despised others. Here's two men that came. One was a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. And at this point of the story, most Pharisees would say, oh, he's going to say something really good about us. We're the 6,000 separated ones, and we're washing our hands right. And then the other's a tax collector, and that's a horrible, that's one of the worst possible types of people. Says, God, I thank you, I'm not like the other men. I'm not an extortioner, unjust, adulterer, or even as the tax collector. And then what's the first thing it says about the Pharisee? I fast twice a week. Yes, every Thursday, every Monday, that Pharisee was on it. He gave tithes of all that he possesses. But then the tax collector, standing afar off, wouldn't even raise his eyes to heaven, beat his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. And I tell you, this man that went down to his house justified, was justified, not the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. So to start with this theory of beware the leaven in the New Testament, it's clean to say and clear to say we should beware the leaven of the Pharisees. It's now moving from a physical staying away from leaven because it's remembering haste from the Old Testament to spiritually, we need to stay away from hypocrisy. We need to stay away from the things that the Pharisees were doing that was then going against the teachings of Christ. But now let's turn to Matthew chapter 16 and verse 6, where it's going to add another category for the leaven that we should be avoiding. So Matthew chapter 16 and verse 6. Now when the disciples had come to the other side, they'd forgotten to take bread. Then Jesus said to them, take heed and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees. Oh, we've got that right. That's the hypocrisy and that's the separated ones. But wait a second. Also the Sadducees. So here's another category that we should be thinking about, how we stay away from leaven, beware of leaven, from a New Testament perspective. So if the words that I like to associate with the Pharisees are tradition and choice, there's two words I'd like to associate with the Sadducees. Most of you probably know one of them. One of the jokes or common statements would be that Sadducees were sad because of their doctrine, right? Then what was their doctrine? They didn't believe in a resurrection. So if you think that you only have a chance to live for today, that's not something that should bring much joy or happiness with that thought. So one word association with Sadducees is they were sad because they didn't believe that there was a resurrection. A second word I'd like to associate with the Sadducees is they were born sad. A person didn't choose to become a Sadducee. Oftentimes, and the majority of times we'll talk this through, they were born sad. And what this means is a Sadducee was tied by birth. It was heredity. Sadducees traced back, it's the priestly line, four primary families. Josephus, on page 423, talks about Annas. So we're talking a little bit about Annas and Caiaphas coming up. But Josephus, on page 423, says, Annas was one of the most fortunate men. He, by himself, and five sons, and a son-in-law, were all high priests. So over 100 years of when the Romans were ruling the Israel, there were 28 high priests. 50 of those 100 years, those high priests were Annas, or his sons, or his son-in-law. So it's Sadducees were very much tied to the priesthood, tied to lineage, and the ability that a person was then born into that. So let's highlight what this then is going to set up as the controversy or the challenge that the Sadducees, or one of them, that then that created with Christ. So let's start with Leviticus chapter 12. Leviticus chapter 12. When I was reading this earlier, I decided I need to be really careful with what I say. So, Leviticus chapter 12, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel, saying, if a lady's conceived, born a male child, then she shall be unclean for 7 days. Let's go down to verse 5. But if she bears a female child, then she shall be unclean for 2 weeks. Why is it 7 days versus 2 weeks? I have no idea, and I'll say nothing else about it. So then let's continue on. So, verse 6. When the days of purification are fulfilled, whether for a son or for a daughter, she'll bring to the priest a lamb of the first year as a burnt offering and a young pigeon or a turtle dove as a sin offering. Then it continues down to verse 8. But if she's not able to bring a lamb, then she may bring two turtle doves or two young pigeons. So here's a question. Where would she get the lambs or the doves or the pigeons from? Back then, it wasn't specified. So I grew up on a small farm. I had up to 40 sheep when I was in high school. So I would imagine that maybe if people had sheep, and then a mom would then go out and pick a lamb, and then that lamb would then be the sacrifice. And she would say, well, this would be a good lamb, or ask the somebody to go find a lamb. If they didn't have the means to have a lamb, they either, if they didn't raise them, they'd purchase them, or if they didn't have the means for that, then turtle doves or young pigeons. But then how did they get turtle doves or young pigeons? I don't know. So maybe it's like, hey, get a net or go find a blanket and somebody's got to hang out in the tree and go catch some turtle doves or pigeons. And that's the way it was back then. But the idea was that the lamb was supposed to be without blemish. And that was an important category. So now with that as the background, sacrificial system continued on. Now let's go to Luke chapter 19. So Luke chapter 19 and verse 45. What happened here? Then he, Jesus Christ, went into the temple and began to drive out those who bought and sold in it, saying to them, it's written, my house is a house of prayer, but you have made it a den of thieves. Where did this take place? Josephus labeled this, it was the marketplace of Annas. Annas was a Sadducee. Annas was the high priest, and all of his family then became multiple sons, high priest to follow. And they had a racket that was going on. And the racket was, they could manage or control if a lamb was deemed blemish-free. And for some reason, if a mother went out and picked a lamb from her little flock and brought it in, a blemish could almost always be found. But there's a special deal at the marketplace of Annas for the other lambs, and they somehow charged 3 or 4 times more because those were the ones that were blemish-free. So there was a whole monetary racket that was managed by the Sadducees, the chief priests especially, and that's where Christ was cleaning the temple, saying, you've made it a house of prayer, you've made it a den of thieves. The same thing with the money changers. So the people that were really profiting from that exchange was the Sadducees. So now let's continue on to John chapter 18. So a little bit of a trick question. Christ was in the Garden of Gethsemane. He's then arrested. Where did he go first? To the high priest, right? Not really. Kind of. So let's go to John chapter 18. Let's start with verse 12. The detachment of troops and the captain, the officers of the Jews, arrested Jesus and bound him. And they led him away to Annas first, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas. Annas had been the high priest. He lost his chance for a little while. So what would happen is, if there's any disturbance, any problems, or the bribes weren't big enough, then the high priest would be removed, and they'd have to find another high priest. So Annas was, then he wasn't. After a couple of sons, then it was his son-in-law, Caiaphas, who was the high priest for that year. And that really signifies that year, it was a bit of a revolving door for that 100 years with the priests. So then it was Caiaphas who advised the Jews that it was expedient that one man should die for the people. Why did Caiaphas really care, really get so upset about Jesus Christ and what he was doing? I think there's a couple of things. One is any insurrection would have been put down by the Romans, and that would have had a direct impact then on the high priest. The other is Jesus Christ came to the temple a couple of times and was ruining his family business. What about those unblemished sheep that he was able to sell for 3 or 4 times the market price, or however that market was going? So we'll continue on. Simon Peter followed Jesus, and so did another disciple. This other disciple was John. He just didn't label himself. Now that disciple was known to the high priest. Here's something else I learned. So John and James, they were fishermen, the sons of thunder, and apparently they had a friendship with the high priest. How did that happen? I don't know. And what was the relationship? But it's interesting when I go to one more part to follow. But then the other disciple was known to the high priest, went out and spoke to her. So John was going back and forth. Peter was outside, and we know that story. And I just thought it was interesting that how that tied through with Annas and Caiaphas. Let's expand this point, just a couple of other scriptures. Go to Acts chapter 4. Let's start with verse 5. And it came to pass on the next day that their rulers, elders, and scribes, as well as Annas, the high priest, Caiaphas, John and Alexander, who are also brothers of and sons of Annas, as many were of the family of the high priest, so it just again emphasizes the family heredity tied to Sadducees, were gathered together at Jerusalem. And when they had to set them in the midst, they asked, by what power or what name have you done this? Now let's continue on just a little bit more. Acts chapter 5, verse 17. Then the high priest rose up, and all those who were with him, so this would have been Caiaphas, which is the sect of the Sadducees, and they were filled with indignation and laid their hands on the apostles, put them in the common prison, but at night the angel of the Lord opened them up, go and stand in the temple, and when he had heard that they had entered the temple early in the morning and taught, the high priest and those with him came and called the council together, and with all the elders of the children of Israel, and sent to prison to have them brought. So here's the apostles are now on trial with Caiaphas and his brothers, and probably his father was there as well. Let's continue to verse 24. Now when the high priest, the captain of the temple, and the chief priest heard these things, they wondered what the outcome would be. So one came and told them, look, the men whom you put in prison are standing in the temple and teaching the people. And it continues down, and this is where in verse 33 or 34, then one in the council stood up, a Pharisee named Gamaliel. So he's now a Pharisee standing up in this group of the Sadducees, a part of the Sanhedrin, to then tell his story. And now Gamaliel says, we need to give these men a chance. If it's of God, there's nothing you can do to overthrow it. So the concept here is we are to beware of the leaven. We're to beware of the leaven of the Pharisees tied to the choices that they made, placing the oral traditions as being even more important than God's law and God's word. It added the Sadducee, the leaven of the Sadducees that we're supposed to be aware of. And when I was doing the research, it could be a couple of things. So what is the leaven that we're supposed to be aware of with them? Well, actually, sorry, I want to add one more concept, and then I'll get to that summary thought. Mark chapter 8 and verse 15. Did you know there's one more group of leavening that we're supposed to watch out for? Mark chapter 8 and verse 15. Then he charged them, take heed, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees. You can say, yes, I know. And the leaven of Herod. What was the leaven of Herod? Well, that's also translated of the Herodians, and they were known for their desire to submit to Herod and his rule in exchange for political favor. So it would be like, everything's okay if it's what Herod wants us to do. And that would just be giving away their beliefs or not being then legitimate to their following. Let's go to Matthew 22 as we wrap this thought up. Matthew chapter 22. And I thought, as I was reading this, that it was a little bit of a game of ping pong. It was a game of ping pong between the Pharisees and the Sadducees primarily. And so let's just go through, and the Herodians are mentioned as well. So Matthew 22, and let's just start with verse 15 to give a few highlights. The Pharisees went out and plotted how they might entangle him in his talk. This is Christ. And they sent to him their disciples with the Herodians. So we already know we are to beware of the leaven of who? All of these groups. The Herodians saying, teacher, we know that you're true and teach the way of God and truth, nor do you care about anyone, for you do not regard the person of men. Tell us then, do we need to pay taxes to Caesar? So what did Jesus Christ respond with? Why do you test me, you hypocrites? That's one of the leavens we need to be aware of. Show me the tax money. We then go through the story here. It was Caesar's image, and then that's it. And then on verse 22, they heard these things, they marveled, and they left him and went their way. So it's almost like, we're going to set him up. We're going to get him. Oh, he foiled us again. So now what happens? The same day, verse 23, the Sadducees, who say there's no resurrection, so that's a doctrinal issue there, or a doctrinal issue, came to him and asked him, saying, teacher, Moses said if a man dies having no children, his brother should marry his wife. And we go through this question now, what if there's all these different wives, then who, therefore in the resurrection, whose wife of the seven will she be, for they all had her as a wife? So, and here it's interesting, if they don't believe in a resurrection, why are they asking a question about the resurrection? So they're trying to trick Jesus Christ into an answer of, if you think the resurrection is possible, how can there be an answer for seven deaths and how's it going to work as a spirit being? Jesus Christ, verse 29, you're mistaken, not knowing the scriptures nor the power of God. So it goes through with the answer. So then what happens? Verse 34, here's the ping pong. But when the Pharisees heard that he had silenced the Sadducees, they gathered together. Then one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question, testing him and saying, teacher, what's the greatest commandment in the law? Jesus Christ said, you shall love the Lord your God, all your heart, all your soul, all your mind. This is the first and great commandment. Second commandment, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these the two commandments hang. So then what happened? Verse 40, Pharisees gathered together. Jesus asked them, saying, what do you think about the Christ? Whose son is he? And then they said to themselves, the son of David. He said to them, how then does David call him Lord? Continues through. And then chapter 23 then starts the woe to the scribes and the Pharisees. So there's no need to read through all these verses, but I would just encourage you at some point, read through it and circle the times. Pharisees, Sadducees, Herodians, scribes. They're setting up questions. Jesus Christ gives an answer. They're setting up another question. Oh, he just stopped that one. Here comes another one. And now here comes through on verse 23. Here are all the woes to the scribes and to the Pharisees. So the summary thought here on the beware of the leaven, Pharisees, hypocrisy, taught for doctrines and commandments of men. Sadducees, possibly doctrine tied to resurrection. Hypocrisy was mentioned as well. Maybe it was the business scam, how Jesus Christ was turning over the temple, or turning over the money changers and the marketplace of Annas. Herodians, political expediency. And then they also work with the Pharisees for how they might destroy Christ. So now there's just a couple of last concluding scriptures. 1 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 6. So we've talked a lot so far in the New Testament around purging out beware the leaven. Let's start to expand this into the point of freedom. So 1 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 6. Your glorying is not good. Do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump? Therefore, purge out the old leaven that you may be a new lump, since you are truly unleavened. For indeed, Christ our Passover was sacrificed for us. And that's the beginning of freedom, right? So Christ's sacrifice is what opens up the opportunity and for God's plan to be realized for all of us and for all the world. But therefore, let us keep the feast, not with old leaven, nor with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. The part that I'd like to emphasize here is, therefore, let us keep the feast. When I was doing the research in the commentaries, there is an awful lot of work trying to understand or trying to describe why that doesn't really mean, therefore, let us keep the feast. It's pretty tough, right? So how, it's only an allegory, it's only spiritual, it's only, do it all the time. It's like, well, no, this should be a pretty simple thing. So here we are talking about leaven. This is the meaning of the day. This is an annual reminder of this part in God's plan, that Christ our Passover was sacrificed for us, and therefore let us keep the feast, not with old leaven, nor with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, so just a couple of pages over, 10 and verse 1 through 4. Moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea. Well, we've talked about that. 2 to 4 million people went through the sea, all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, all ate the same spiritual food, all drank the same spiritual drink. They drank out of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. John chapter 8 and verse 31. John chapter 8 and verse 31. With the thought of celebrating freedom, Jesus said to those Jews who believed him, "If you abide in my word, you are my disciples indeed, and you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." You can jump down to verse 36 where it says, "Therefore, if the Son makes you free, you shall be free indeed." So the truth makes us free, our understanding of the truth. The Son makes us free. We shall then be free indeed. Very last scripture, Galatians chapter 5. So Galatians chapter 5, verse 1, "Stand fast, therefore, in the liberty by which Christ has made us free, and do not become entangled again with the yoke of bondage." And let's conclude with verse 13. "For you, brethren, have been called to liberty. Only don't use liberty as an opportunity for the flesh, but through love serve one another. For all the law is fulfilled in one word, even in this, you shall love your neighbor as yourself."